Satan guy. He arrested you even though you'd done nothing wrong.
Oh, my God,
Faye said, looking at him and grabbing his arm. He said you put him in that wheelchair. He said it was your fault he's disabled.
That's ridiculous. How do you know all this?
I tracked down Alice. You remember her? She was your neighbor in college.
You talked to her?
She told me all about you when you were at Circle.
Why are you talking to these people?
Alice said you should leave the country right now. They rounded a corner, came into view of her building, and saw a strange clump of activity up ahead. A large police van with big block letters on the side, SWAT, was parked next to Samuel's car, towering over it like a bear guarding dinner. Police were exiting Faye's building and leaping into the van's open rear door. They were dressed in black, militarily bulletproofed, helmeted, goggled, machine guns strapped tightly to their chests. Samuel and his mother ducked back around the corner.
What is going on?
Faye said. Samuel shrugged. Is there another way in? She nodded and he followed her down the block, into an empty alley, to a rusted red door next to several garbage bins. They were quiet as they ascended the stairs, quiet as they listened from the stairwell to the last of the police exit her building. They waited another 10 minutes to be sure, then exited the stairwell and walked down the hall to her apartment's front door, which they found in pieces, lying at an angle on the floor, connected to the wall only by the bottom hinge, which was twisted and bent. Inside her apartment, the furniture had been tipped over and torn apart. The cushions on the couch were in tatters. The bed mattress lay on the floor, a long rip down the middle where the stuffing had been yanked out, an incision from top to bottom as if it hadn't been searched but rather autopsied. Mattress fluff all over. Books that had been on the bookshelves were now scattered and bent. The kitchen cabinets were open, everything inside either knocked down or broken. The trash can overturned and dumped on the floor, slivers of glass crunching under their shoes. They were looking at each other, bewildered, when a noise came from the bathroom, a whoosh of water, a faucet turned on and off. Then the door opened, and there emerged, wiping his hands on his tan slacks, Simon Rogers. He saw them and smiled.
Well, hello there!
Simon, Faye said.
What happened?
Oh, he said, with a wave of his hand. The police were here.
3. Today was the day he would quit Elfscape. Today he would stop playing forever, is what Ponage resolved yesterday, actually, when he sat down vowing to quit Elfscape, but then found several matters that needed addressing in order to settle his affairs, as it were, before sending his excellently geared avatars into digital oblivion. Primarily among these was saying goodbye to the dozens of guildmates who over time he'd come to think of very fondly and feel a responsibility and paternalistic affection for, rather like how a summer camp counselor might feel for the kids in his charge. And Ponage knew that if he disappeared without saying goodbye, they would feel a sharp and personal betrayal, and a sense of loss without closure, and a shock to their sense that the world was predictable and understandable, and for the most part good and just and fair. A few of these guildies, incidentally, really were the age of summer camp kids, and he felt an especially strong impulse not to betray or wound them in any way. And so he decided pretty early on in the play session that began yesterday morning that he could not quit and delete his account until he'd personally, privately chatted with and said goodbye to the many regular Elfscape players that he'd played with for roughly 12 hours a day for the last couple of years, which required him to write a heartfelt note of gratitude to each player and an explanation that he no longer had the time to play World of Elfscape, since he was now turning his attention to a brand new career, that of being a famous detective mystery novelist. And he explained to his colleagues that he would have a big-time New York publisher just as soon as he finished a first draft of his novel, and so he needed to turn his efforts to book writing in a full-on, 100% type of way, which meant giving up Elfscape because his normal Elfscape schedule interfered with writing. the daily quests especially, the hundreds of daily quests he completed every morning on all his various avatars in a punishing 5-hour grind, after which he'd vow to skip the daily quests the next day and instead use that time to make some serious progress in his detective novel, figuring he could probably write about 2 pages an hour, which was a reasonable number according to various online novel writing self-help websites. And thus, about 10 pages a day, and at this clip, he could finish the detective novel in a month, using only the time he usually spent on Elfscape dailies. And this feeling of determination and resolve would hold pretty strong until the following morning, when he would try to write his novel, but instead find himself thinking about all the daily quests that were now unlocked and newly available again. And he'd make an agreement with himself that in order to get the quests off his mind, and really be able to focus on the novel writing, he'd take a break and do the quests on his main character only. And if his various secondary characters could not ultimately have access to all the excellent rewards, well, so be it. That was the price he'd have to pay for becoming a famous mystery thriller writer. But then after finishing the 20 quests on his main avatar, he'd get that disconcerting mental fatigue that felt as if his brain had been kneaded like bread dough, squeezed and pressed and soft and certainly not in the state to produce great literature. And so he went ahead and did all the daily quests on all his alt characters too, and 5 hours later he felt that same bitter disgust with himself he'd felt the day before, vowing again that the next day he would skip the daily quests and work on his novel all day long, a feeling that never seemed as powerful the following morning, when the cycle would repeat, until eventually he had to admit that the only way the novel was going to get written was if he quit the game completely and deleted all his characters in an apocalyptic move there was just no going back from. But of course, not before saying goodbye to all the people who were friends with him. People who, when he told them he was quitting in order to spend more time with his book, usually responded at first with, "No!" Which, if he was being honest, was delightful. Followed by an expression of confidence that they knew the book would be a huge, best-selling hit. And even though they didn't know anything about the novel, or even Pwnage's real name, still he very much liked being told of his inevitable future success, which kept him sitting in his chair for many hours waiting on each of his Elfscape friends to log on one by one so that he could tell them the news and have a version of the same conversation he had already had about 24 times, during which he'd been sitting in exactly the same position with one leg tucked under his body for so long that his leg skin was deeply imprinted with the lines of his faux leather plastic chair. While, meanwhile, he was developing inside his leg what doctors would call a deep vein thrombosis, or in other words, a blood clot, which was causing redness and swelling in the leg, as well as a slight ache and tenderness and warmth and pain that he might have felt had the leg not already gone way beyond the pins and needles stage and into complete and almost anesthetic numbness due to the prolonged compression it endured while he said goodbye to friends and explained his upcoming account deletion and often did one last quest or dungeon run with these friends for, as they said, old time's sake. And he was surprised how nostalgic this made him feel. This, by the way, being one of the reasons he'd forgotten to move his legs, or stand, or stretch, or in any way get the blood circulating in the lower trunk, or anywhere but the thumbs and digits strictly necessary for effective video game operation. Nostalgic that his friends wanted to revisit scenes of former triumph with the same verve that some people really looked forward to their high school reunions. And so, with each friend, he'd repeat some adventure they'd shared weeks or months ago, and this gave Pwnage the idea that he wanted to visit all of the spots on the immense Elfscape map that he was fond of, or had some important memory about, or were in any way significant to his development as a serious gamer, a kind of farewell tour of the places he'd come to know and adore, and which, of course, would take, seriously, like hours and hours. The game's developers made a lot of hay about the huge size and scale of their virtual world, saying that if the Elfscape world were real, it would literally be about the size of the moon. And so he visited the Silverglade Forest, site of his avatar's first death at level 8 due to lurking panthers, and the caves of Jedinar, close scrape with a pack of demons, and the Shrine of Ilenna, because of the awesome soundtrack that played while in the shrine, and the Wormist Strand, where he encountered his first dragon, and the Gurubashi Ruins, where he murdered his first orc, and so on, just loving all these weird place names, and he flew from spot to spot in his ultra-fast flying griffin, then remembered how interesting it was when he was new to the game, and had not earned any flying or riding animals yet, and had to walk through the countryside and really take it in and enjoy the way one ecosystem gave way to another, and he longed for the simplicity and naivete of those days, and so he parked his griffin on the northern tip of the world's largest continent and began walking south. First through the white snowy tundra of the Winter Saber glaciers, over the Timber Frost mountains, and down into Frost Thistle Gorge, happening upon only a few occasional charging wildebeests or polar bears, through caves controlled by a semi-sentient race of ice yeti he was friendly with, and on south, walking and occasionally taking screen grabs the way tourists take photographs, and seeing orc players who ran like hell from him because they knew his name and he had a badass reputation. And by this time, the online message boards were lighting up with the news that the game's most dominant and elite player was retiring. And Pwnage kept getting all these private messages asking if it was true and pleading with him to change his mind. Messages that were actually having the effect of changing his mind because he was suddenly aware that he was possibly way more popular and supported and loved as an Elfscape avatar than he ever would be as an in-real-life human being. And this made him feel sad and sort of panicky. And he remembered the anxiety of this last patch day when he couldn't log on to Elfscape for almost an entire day, and he walked circles around every room in his house and stared at the mailbox for hours. And so as he now walked south through the vast Elfscape terrain, he felt a crushing and excessive stress and dread that if he went through with the whole quitting video games thing, then every day would be like the last patch day, and the realization of this washed over him like a cold rain, and he felt his willpower and commitment to the plan erode, and he decided that the only way he'd ever be able to bring himself to really quit Elfscape was if his characters were no longer the elite and super cool characters that earned everyone's love and support. And the only way that would happen was if he got rid of all the treasure he'd worked tirelessly for, the thinking here being that he might be less roundly loved and popular and elite, and therefore more likely to quit if he didn't have all his epic loot. Plus, it would be so frustrating to go back to the bottom of the totem pole after being on top for so long. So annoying to earn all that loot back again. So pointless that he would prefer to quit. And so he announced to his guildmates that he was giving away all his possessions, and if they came to find him on his long walk south, he would give them something really cool and valuable. And soon he was followed by a pack of lesser players in a kind of parade. At this point, it's important to note the deep thrombosis in his leg had shaken free at the moment he reached his epiphany and announced the news to the guild and switched from sitting on one leg to sitting on the other leg. And the clot was now slowly making its way up his circulatory system, a small, hard glob about the size of a marble, pushing through his body that registered occasionally as a tightness and sometimes a shooting pain, which frankly did not separate itself from the biologic human noise Pwnage felt mostly all the time. Pain stemming from near-constant exhaustion and immobility and surviving on a diet consisting mostly of caffeine and frozen microwavable processed food things, a condition that caused regular shooting pain all over his body. And meant the shooting pain that was now caused by his newly mobile blood clot made no impression on him as anything out of the ordinary, since he felt some kind of stabbing pain almost all the time. And anyway, the stabbing was blunted by the fact that he rarely actually remembered the stabbing pain, as his brain's frontal lobe and hippocampus had been severely atrophied from sleep deprivation, malnutrition, and exposure to computer screens at a volume that seems to be dangerous in a way scientists don't even understand yet. So that each time he felt the stabbing pain, his overtired, morbidly taxed brain promptly ejected the information, so that the next time he felt the shooting, stabbing, awful pain, it was like he was feeling it for the first time. Duly noting it and thinking that if it happened again, he'd definitely seek some kind of help from some manner of health professional within probably the next week or so, maybe. And as his friends all gathered around him, he began giving away first his gold, the many coins of gold, silver, and copper that he'd looted from the dead bodies of slain orc players and gathered from treasure chests guarded by dragons, and earned on the server's auction house, where he'd learned to manipulate the various raw material exchanges, and leverage his wealth into far greater wealth by exerting near-monopolistic control of the Elfscape supply chain. And he was aware that all this gold had real-world value, that some people sold their Elfscape gold on real-world auction sites to other Elfscape players for real American dollars. And he was aware that a Stanford economist had even invented a WOE gold-to-dollar currency converter that, if correct, meant that he could sell his gold and make at least as much money as he did when he worked at that copy shop. A thing he would never do because Elfscape was fun, and he knew from experience that jobs were not. Except, if he really thought about it, he'd say his Elfscape game experience was not 100% fun, since each day's playing began with 5 hours of the same rote daily quests completed over and over until they achieved the monotony typical of manual labor, which was, of course, not very fun, but which unlocked rewards that would allow him to have fun later when he used them, except when he finally earned the rewards, the game's developers would by that time have issued a new patch that made available new rewards that were slightly, incrementally, better than the old rewards. And so even as he earned these rewards, he knew they were already devalued because better rewards were right there on the horizon. And if he thought about it really hard, he'd say that most of his Elfscape game experience involved him preparing to have fun, but never really having it. The fun, except in those raids when, working together with his guild, he took down some importantly evil enemy and won some cool loot. But even then, it was only fun the first couple of times they succeeded, and after that it became just a repeatable exercise that no longer provided fun, per se, and which actually caused a great deal of stress and rage when the guild failed some week where they had succeeded the week before. And so most raid nights were less about having fun and more about anger avoidance, and so he concluded the fun must have been happening elsewhere. Maybe not even in the discrete game moments themselves, but in the general abstract state of playingness, because when he was logged onto Elfscape, he felt a deep sense of satisfaction and mastery and belonging that he felt nowhere in the real world, and this feeling might be what he would interpret as fun. All of which is to say that Pwnage had a vast fortune indeed, and when he began giving away his wealth in 1,000 gold coin increments, it still took many dozens of players coming to collect before the purse was depleted, which made Pwnage feel something like Robin Hood walking through the forest, giving away fortunes to the needy, and when his fortune was gone, he began giving away his gear, clicking randomly on people in the very large crowd around him and giving them his weapons, his long swords, broad swords, his cleavers, claymores, rapiers, daggers, dirks, sabers, sickles, scimitars, shivs, axes, cudgels, hatchets, hammers, tomahawks, maces, picks, staves, polearms, pikes, spears, halberds, and one mysterious weapon he didn't even remember obtaining called a flammard. And when he had no more weapons to give, he gave away his body armor, the various pieces of chainmail and plate metal he'd won and plundered, The kick-ass pauldrons with the spikes all over them, the greaves covered in razor wire, the awesome helmet with bull's horns that made him look like the goddamn Minotaur. Already this bounty was becoming legendary, as several players were taking video footage of Ponage's long walk south and posting it online with captions like, "Epic player gives away all his loots." And at first, Ponage felt sharp pangs of regret, giving away his stuff because he loved his stuff, and also because he knew how much time and effort went into acquiring every item. The bull's head helmet alone took like 2 months to win. But that feeling soon gave way to an unexpected sense of calm purpose, and spiritual goodness and generosity, and even warmth and peace. This might have been the exhaustion talking, as he'd been playing Elfscape at this point for 30 hours straight. As he shed all his possessions, and he was followed now by his many admirers, and he was feeling like he was maybe inspiring these people, and should maybe say something important and wise, and he wondered whether there was a Buddha story like this, or maybe it was Gandhi, or Jesus, a story about giving everything away and walking. This all sounded really familiar. And Ponage eventually thought of this whole episode not as a last-ditch desperate effort to quit a game he did not seem to have the willpower to quit, but rather as an altruistic and spiritual journey of renunciation. Like he was doing something good and important, charity-wise, being a role model for all these people, and this feeling held pretty strongly and pleasantly until the crowd began to thin. Which it did, when it was clear he had no more loot to give away, people began to private message him asking, "Is that it? Is there any more?" And he realized they were not there to join him on his long metaphysical journey. But instead they simply wanted cool new toys to play with. And Ponage felt angry at their crass materialism, until he remembered that this was the point of the whole giving away all his possessions maneuver in the first place. That he would be abandoned, and therefore not tempted to continue playing Elfscape due to his drastically diminished popularity. But now that it happened, now that he actually had been abandoned, now that he was walking through the big open country without weapons or armor or gold or friends, just an elf in a loincloth, pathetic looking, weak, he still did not feel much like quitting. And so he kept walking south until he reached the bottom of the continent, a rocky plateau that looked out over the ocean, and he knew he'd reached the end of his journey and knew it was time to log off and delete his account, and begin living his real-life life, and writing his novel, and becoming successful, and winning Lisa back, and starting his diet, and doing the all-around radical change that was necessary to live the way he wanted to live. And even though he could no longer think of a single excuse to stay in the game, and even though there was literally nothing his avatar could do now in its state of total poverty and nakedness, still, he could not log off. Still, he stared out at the digital ocean. Still, the thought of abandoning the game and returning to the real world filled him with dread. A dread more powerful than anything most normally functional human adults ever experience due to the serious problems of brain physiology and neural microstructure reorganization that had gone down inside his cranium during his addict-level Elfscape binges, which had, along with the inevitable physical tolls like weight gain and muscle waste, and back fatigue and a semi-permanent knot on the back of his ribcage that seemed correlated with repetitive right-handed mouse usage, also severely degenerated the tissue of his rostral anterior cingulate cortex, an area in the front of the brain that acts as a kind of recruiter, engaging the other more rational brain areas to aid during conflicts. Think of a very impulsive and distraught person calling more level-headed friends to get some perspective and objective advice, and is necessary for proper cognitive and impulse control, except in Ponage, this area had begun to shut down completely, like a house that took down all its Christmas lights, just deactivating, which was what happened in the brains of heroin-dependent individuals when presented with heroin. Their anterior cingulate cortex is shut down, and they got no decision-making input from the quote-unquote smart parts of their brains, and their brains offered them literally no help with overcoming their most basic, primal, self-destructive impulses. Impulses with which they needed the most help to overcome. Which was precisely what was happening to Ponage as he looked out at the sea. He functionally remembered the desire to quit Elfscape, but there was no part of his brain actively telling him to do so. Plus, there was the problem of decreased gray matter volume in several clusters of the orbital frontal cortex, responsible for goal orientation and motivation. This atrophy resulting in a brain that was aware of the existence of a goal, but did not offer any aid achieving that goal, instead idly seeing the goal on the horizon, and noting the goal the way Midwestern farmers note the weather. Yep, rain's coming. Which was another of Elfscape's neurobiological traps, that the more he played Elfscape, the more his brain was unable to compute any but the most short-term and proximate goals, which happened to be the goals of Elfscape itself. The way the game was designed to reward players every 1 or 2 hours, with some cool new piece of loot or a new level gained or achievement accomplished, which was accompanied by a horn fanfare and fireworks animations. And becoming habituated to these kinds of insidious, small, near-future goals made any long-term goals that required substantial planning and discipline and mental fortitude, like writing a novel or starting a new diet, seem for the brain literally unfathomable. Not to mention the problems happening deep inside his brain's internal capsule, posterior limb, the only part of Ponage's brain to have strengthened during his massive, unyielding addiction to Elfscape, where the primary motor cortex sent its axons that controlled fine finger movements. And Ponage had excellent fine finger agility, clicking with his right hand on his many-button mouse and with his left hand a full 104-key Western keyboard, keeping a mental map of all this so that he could press any one of these hundreds of keys and buttons in a split second without even looking at them. This behavior having changed the actual physical structure of his brain and greatly thickened the axons in the internal capsule. The problem here being that such giant finger control fibers were never, in an evolutionary sense, strictly necessary. There's no equivalent in our human ancestry to a 15-button electronic gaming mouse, and so the area available within the capsule was limited and not very accommodating to unexpected growth, meaning that Ponage's giant finger-related white matter was crowding out other essential brain tissues, primarily communication tracts between the frontal and subcortical brain regions, which governed executive decision-making, and which, among other things, helped inhibit inappropriate behaviors. Which may have explained Ponage's actions at the organic health food store, specifically, and his actions over the last year more generally. His slow wasting away in front of his computer, his lack of sleep, his diet, his delusions of grandeur about becoming a famous author and winning Lisa back. The partial mini-seizures he didn't even know were happening, the seizures caused either by sleep deprivation or flashing computer lights or severe nutrition-related chemical imbalances, or all three of those things together probably, that presented physically as a loss of sensation in various limbs and the sudden need to pick at his own skin, and seeing sparkly things at the edge of his vision. Symptoms that Ponage might have gotten a medical opinion about if his dorsolateral prefrontal cortex weren't completely shut down. This brain area being responsible for decision-making and emotion control, and which went dormant in the brains of heavy multitaskers during what might be called information overload. Which, in the event of dormancy, the emotion centers of the brain took over executive control in the neural equivalent of giving the keys to a forklift to a 6-year-old, and Ponage's mind was overloaded indeed, as his computer screen was jammed with the various boxes of add-on software that gave him real-time and constantly influx feedback on his opponent's health. his own available moves, various countdown timers that let him know when other moves would be available again, the attacks that would at that moment inflict the highest damage mathematically possible, the status of each of his raid members, the full party's damage per second output, an overhead bird's eye view of the fight's layout with principal actors color-coded depending on their roles in the fight, all of this happening in addition to the actual game also happening behind all the flashing and glowing boxes. And Ponich monitored not only everything happening on this screen, which itself would be enough to drive your basic slow-living 18th century peasant to near psychotic breaks, but since he usually played while multi-boxing several characters at once, he monitored the events on 6 different computer screens simultaneously, such that he was ingesting way more information per second than all the air traffic controllers at O'Hare put together, making that very sensitive and logical brain part essentially wave the white flag and hide, allowing his emotion centers to easily shut down whatever was left of his logical, rational, disciplined mind, which meant, to put it simply, that the more Elfscape he played, the more impossible it felt to stop playing Elfscape. And this went way beyond simply kicking a bad habit and into problems of brain morphology and a kind of fundamental neural disfigurement so complete that Ponage's mind literally would not allow him to quit Elfscape. Which was what he was realizing, standing on the southern edge of the continent, wondering what to do next, and not coming up with anything, and so just standing there. Until finally, one of his enemy proximity alarms went off, and the game's camera auto-flipped to reveal an orc player behind him, spying from a great distance. And what he would usually do in this moment would be to charge the orc and slam it with his shield, and then hack at it with his axe of unusual size until it was good and dead. And even though he currently had no shield or axe, or really anything with which to attack the orc, he reflexively went to attack it. Except that he couldn't. Something was preventing it. He felt hazy, and nauseous, and lightheaded, and found he couldn't move his arms, or, come to think of it, breathe. It should be mentioned here that the blood clot that had formed in his leg was by now a full-blown pulmonary embolism that was currently blocking blood flow to the lungs and which caused substantial chest pain whenever Ponage breathed, combined with a desperate desire to breathe more. Ponage registering this mostly as a quick dimming of the light, almost as if the sun had gone down all at once, skipping twilight and plunging directly into nocturnal darkness. And when Ponage did not attack the orc player moved closer, gaining confidence, a step or two at a time, testing him, ready to run, until the orc was in melee range, and Ponage desperately wanted to attack it, except that he couldn't move under the weight of what felt like an anvil on his chest. And when Ponage did not move, the orc player removed from his belt a small dagger, and, after a brief moment where he was probably wondering if this was a good idea, and not a put-on by the server's most famous elf warrior, the orc stabbed him. Then stabbed him again. Then again. And Ponage's loincloth elf stood there wobbling and taking it while alarms went off everywhere and his health bar dropped and he sat there watching in horror, unable to move as the darkness closed in and his field of vision narrowed and he lost all control of his motor functions and his lips and fingertips turned blue. And his elf warrior eventually, after so many wounds, dropped down dead. And Ponich watched the orc dance on his own fallen corpse, and the last thing he saw before the lights went off completely was a message from the orc player saying, ZOMG, I pwned your face, ROF, LOLOLOLOLOL. And Ponich resolved that he would earn all his treasure back, and become twice as powerful as before, just so he could hunt down this one fucking orc and kill him over and over and over. And he would start doing that as soon as he could move his legs and arms again and breathe, and for that matter, see. And even as all his systems were in a cascading, catastrophic failure, his brain told him his number one priority right now was killing this orc, which he would never be able to do, because today was the day he was quitting Elfscape, and since his mind would not let him do it, his body had to do it for him.
4. Simon Rogers paced through Faye's wrecked apartment, stepping carefully to avoid debris on the floor, and explaining that there were certain laws that allowed all this. When he said all this, he said it with a sweep of his arms, meaning the apartment's general desecration and ruin. Certain statutes passed after 9/11 governing the searches of terrorist suspects, the allowable use of military force. Basically, he said, the police can send a SWAT team whenever they want, and we have no way to stop it, prevent it, countermand it, or redress it. Faye was in the kitchen, silent, stirring tea in her one unbroken mug. What were they looking for? Samuel asked. He kicked at the remains of the television, which had been fractured by some kind of blunt force, its electronic guts scattered over the floor. Simon shrugged. It's procedure, sir. Since your mother is being charged with domestic terrorism, they're allowed to do this. So they did it. She's not a terrorist. Yes, but since she's being charged under a statute designed for sleeper cell Al-Qaeda agents, they have to treat her as if she might actually be one. This is so fucked up. The law was written at a time when folks were not that interested in the Fourth Amendment, or the Fifth Amendment for that matter, or actually the Sixth. He chortled lightly to himself. Or the Eighth. Don't they need some kind of specific reason to search the house? Samuel said. They do, sir, but they keep it a secret. Don't they need a warrant? Yes, but it's sealed. Who gives them permission? Confidential, sir. And is there anyone watching over all of this? Anyone we can appeal to? There is a sort of habeas process, but it's classified. National security reasons. Mostly, sir, we're meant to trust that the government has our best interests in mind. I should note that this kind of search isn't actually mandatory. It's at the court's discretion. They didn't have to do this. And I know for a fact the prosecutor didn't ask for it. So it was the judge. Technically, that is information withheld from the public, but yes, Judge Brown. We can infer that he ordered it himself. Samuel looked at his mother, who was staring down into her tea. It did not appear that she was drinking the tea so much as intensely stirring it. The wooden spoon she used clunked softly against the sides of the mug. "So what are we going to do?" Samuel said. "I am prepared to mount a vigorous defense, sir, against these new charges. I believe I can persuade a jury that your mother is not a terrorist." "On what grounds?" "Primarily that the recipient of the terrorist threat, Governor Packer, did not actually feel terror."
"You're going to summon Governor Packer?"
"Yes. I'm betting he won't want to admit in public that he was terrified. Of your mom. Not during a presidential campaign."
"That's it? That's your defense?"
"I will also argue that your mother merely made a threatening gesture and did not convey her terroristic threat verbally, electronically, on television, or in writing, which for certain convoluted reasons is a mitigating factor. I'm hoping this will reduce her sentence from life to merely 10 years, maximum security."
"That doesn't sound like a win to me."
"I have to admit that I'm more comfortable in free speech law. Defenses against terrorism are not my, shall we say, cup of tea. Haha."
They looked at Faye, who continued to stare into her mug and had no reaction at all.
"Excuse me," said the lawyer, and he walked between mounds of ripped open pillows and couch cushions and clothes still attached to their hangers into the bathroom. Samuel made his way to the kitchen, each footstep provoking a shriek of broken glass. Food was strewn over the countertops where police had upended the pantry, coffee grounds and cereals and oat bran and rice. The refrigerator was pulled from its place and unplugged, water now dribbling out of it and puddling on the floor. Faye held her mug, which appeared to be handmade from clay, to her chest.
"Mom?"
Samuel said. He wondered what she was feeling right now, given the high-end anxiety med she'd taken earlier that day. Hello? He said. At the moment, she seemed numb to everything. Oblivious. Even the way she stirred her tea was automatic and mechanical. He wondered if the shock of the police raid had put her in some kind of fugue. Mom, are you all right? Can you, like, hear me?
This wasn't supposed to happen, she said finally.
It wasn't supposed to be this way. Tell me you're okay. She stirred her tea and stared into the mug. I've been so stupid.
You've been stupid. This is my fault, Samuel said. I went to see the judge and I made everything worse. I'm really sorry.
I've made such stupid decisions, Faye said, shaking her head. One after the other.
Listen, we should figure out a plan. Alice said we needed to get out of town, maybe even out of the country.
Yeah, I'm beginning to believe her.
Just for a little while. If Brown is retiring soon, why not wait him out? Make sure he knows it will be years before a trial happens. Get rid of him. Get another judge.
Where would we go? Faye said.
I don't know. Canada? Europe? Jakarta?
Actually, no, she said, and she put the mug on the counter. We can't leave the country. I've been charged with terrorism. There's no way they'll let me on an airplane.
Yes, right.
We'll have to trust Simon, I guess.
Trust Simon. I really hope that's not our best option.
What else can we do?
Alice said the judge will never back down. He really seriously wants to put you away forever. This is not a joke. It doesn't feel like a joke.
He said he's in a wheelchair because of you. What did you do to him?
Nothing. I have no idea what he's talking about. Honest.
A rush of plumbing came from the bathroom then, and Simon emerged, little water specks dotting the arms of his sport coat.
Professor Anderson, sir, I'm actually glad you're here. I've been meaning to talk to you about your letter. The letter to the judge that you've been working on tirelessly, I assume?
Right. Yes, what about it?
Well, I wanted to personally thank you, sir, for all your efforts and all the time you've no doubt put into this already, but you should know that we will no longer be needing your services.
My services? Sounds like you're firing me.
Yes, the letter you're writing, that will no longer be necessary.
But my mom is in pretty big trouble.
Oh, yes, she most certainly is, sir.
She needs my help.
She definitely does need help from somebody, sir, but probably not from you. Not anymore.
Why not?
How do I say this delicately? It's just that I've become convinced, sir, that you are not in a position to help her. Probably you'd make things worse. I'm referring, of course, to the scandal.
What scandal?
At the university, sir. Dreadful.
Simon, what the hell are you talking about?
Oh, you haven't seen yet?
Oh, my, I'm so sorry, sir. Seems like I'm always the one to bring you bad news, eh? Perhaps if you checked your email more often or watched the local news?
Simon?
Of course, sir. Well, it looks like there's a brand new student organization that's gaining some serious attention at your school. This organization's purpose, its singular raison d'etre, if you will, seems to be getting you fired.
Seriously?
They have their own website, which has been gleefully shared and circulated by your students, both current and former. You are now pretty much the textbook definition of what PR people call toxic, hence our no longer needing you to vouch for your mother.
Why do my students want me fired?
Perhaps it would be best to look at it yourself.
Simon removed a laptop from his briefcase and called up the website, a new student organization called SAFE. Or Students Against Faculty Extravagance, arguing that university professors were wasting taxpayer money. Their evidence? One Samuel Anderson, a professor of English who, according to the website, abused his office computer privileges. During routine maintenance, the Computer Support Center found logs showing Professor Anderson uses his computer to play World of Elfscape for a frankly shocking number of hours each week. This is a completely unacceptable use of university resources. There was also an associated letter-writing campaign that had gotten the attention of the dean, the press, and the governor's office. Now the whole matter was being sent to the University Disciplinary Committee for a full hearing.
Oh, shit, Samuel said at the thought of explaining Elfscape to a committee of humorless gray-haired professors of philosophy and rhetoric and theology. It made him break out in an immediate sweat.
justifying to his colleagues why he had a robust second life as an elven thief. Oh, God. The president of SAFE was quoted on the website as saying that students needed to be vigorous watchdogs of faculty who wasted their tuition dollars. The student's name was, of course, Laura Potsdam. Fuck this, Samuel said, closing the laptop. He walked over to the expanse of windows on the apartment's north wall and looked out at the jagged city. He remembered Periwinkle's ridiculous advice, that he should declare bankruptcy and move to Jakarta. That was actually sounding pretty good right about now. I think it's time to leave, he said.
Excuse me, sir?
It's time to get on a plane and leave, Samuel said. Leave my job and my life and the whole country. Start fresh somewhere else.
You are, of course, free to do that, sir, but your mother needs to stay here and fight this within the strict confines of the law.
I know.
My various oaths bar me from telling anyone accused of a crime that they should flee the jurisdiction.
Doesn't matter, Samuel said. She can't leave anyway. She'd be on the no-fly list.
Oh, no, sir, she wouldn't be on the list yet.
Samuel turned around. The lawyer was carefully tucking his laptop back into its special briefcase sleeve.
Simon, what do you mean?
Well, the no-fly list is administered by the Terrorist Screening Center, or TSC, which, interestingly, is actually a part of the National Security Branch of the FBI, under the auspices of the Department of Defense. The no-fly list is not, as many people believe, controlled by the Transportation Security Administration, or TSA, which is part of the Department of Homeland Security. They are completely different departments.
Okay, so?
So, to get onto the no-fly list, one's name has to be nominated by an approved government official from the Department of Justice, or Homeland Security, or Defense, or State, or the Postal Service, or certain private contractors, and since each of these agencies has different criteria and guidelines and rules and processes, not to mention different documents and forms that sometimes are incompatible with another administrative agency's equivalent documents and forms, the TSC has to filter through everything and evaluate it and standardize it. This is made infinitely more complicated by the fact that every agency and department uses its own special computer software. Like, for example, the Circuit Court of Cook County uses a Windows operating system that's at least 3 iterations out of date, whereas the FBI and CIA are more Linux-based, I believe. And getting those two systems speaking to each other? Whoo, boy.
Simon, get back to your point.
Of course, sir. What I'm saying is that the information on your mother's status as a terrorist must be processed by the Circuit Court of Cook County's 1st Municipal District, then passed along to the regional FBI office, then to the TSC, where it's evaluated and approved by the TSC's Multi-Agency Operations Branch and Tactical Analysis Group. Then that information needs to percolate over to the Department of Homeland Security, which then sends it along to the TSA in some manner that probably involves a fax machine. All this before the no-fly information is available to individual airport and security personnel.
So my mom is not, in fact, on the no-fly list.
She's not on the no-fly list yet. This whole process usually takes around 48 hours start to finish. More if it's a Friday.
So, hypothetically, if we wanted to leave the country, we could do so as long as we did it today.
That's right, sir. You have to remember we're dealing with huge bureaucracies staffed by people who are, for the most part, criminally underpaid.
Samuel glanced over at his mother, who looked back at him, and after a moment where she seemed to consider this, the gravity of this, gave him a little nod. Simon, he said, thank you so much. You've been very, very helpful.
5. At O'Hare International Airport, Terminal 5, people waited quietly in lines. Lines to get their ticket, lines to drop off their luggage, lines to get through security, all the lines running at such a laggard and reluctant and frankly un-American pace that they forced everyone to fully imbibe the terminal's deeply disorienting combination of melancholy and chaos. The smell of car exhaust from all the taxis outside, and the inside smells of meats that had been cooking all day at Gold Coast Dogs, easy listening standards heavy on saxophone occupied the oral spaces between security announcements, television showing airport news that was different from regular news in unknown ways. Samuel felt disappointed that a foreigner's first impression of America would be made here, and what America was offering them was a McDonald's, whose big message to the incoming throng seemed to be that the McRib was back, in a store specializing in gadgets of questionable necessity. HD video pens, shiatsu massage chairs, wireless Bluetooth-activated reading lamps, heated foot spas, compression socks, automatic wine bottle openers, motorized barbecue grill brushes, orthopedic dog couches, cat thunder shirts, weight loss armbands, gray hair prevention pills, isometric meal replacement packs, liquid protein shots, television swivel stands, hands-free blow dryer holders, a bath towel that said face on one end and butt on the other. This is who we are. Men's bathrooms that required you touch nothing but yourself. Automated dispensers that pooed little globs of generic pink soap onto your hands. Sinks that did not run enough water to fully wash. The same threat level warning issued ad nauseam. The security mandates. Empty your pockets, remove your shoes, laptops out, gels and liquids in separate bags. Repeated so many times that eventually everyone stopped hearing them. All of this so reflexive and automatic and habituated and slow that the travelers were a little zoned out and playing with their phones and just simply enduring this uniquely modern first world ordeal that is not per se difficult, but is definitely exhausting. Spiritually debilitating. Everyone feeling a small ache of regret, suspecting that as a people we could do better, but we don't. The line for a McRib was quiet and solemn and 20 people deep. "I'm feeling a surge of pessimism about our plan," Faye said to Samuel as they stood in the security line. "I mean, do you think they're really going to let us through? Like, oh yes, Miss Fugitive from Justice, right this way." "Would you keep it down?" Samuel said. "I can feel the drugs wearing off. I can feel my anxiety bounding back to me like a lost dog." "We are normal passengers taking a normal vacation abroad. A normal vacation to a country with very strict extradition laws, I sincerely hope." "Don't worry, remember what Simon said." "I can literally feel my confidence in our plan disintegrating. It's like someone has taken our plan and applied a cheese grater. That's what it feels like." "Please be quiet and please relax." They had taken a cab to the airport and purchased one-way tickets on the next available international flight, a non-stop to London. Their boarding passes were issued without a problem. They checked their luggage again without a problem. They waited in the security line. And when they finally handed their tickets and passports to the blue-uniformed TSA agent, whose job it was to visually inspect their photographs and run their tickets over a barcode scanner and wait for the computer to make a pleasant sound and for the light to flash green, the computer did not, in fact, make the pleasant sound. The sound it made instead was the harsh sound like the buzzer at the end of a basketball game, that sound indicating authority and finality. And in case anyone was confused over the sound's meaning, the light also turned red. The security agent sat up straighter at this, surprised at the computer's negative judgment, a rare moment of drama in Terminal 5. "Could you please wait over there?" he said, pointing at an empty little holding pen whose boundaries were demarcated only by strips of dirty purple masking tape on the floor. While they waited, the other travelers glanced at them once or twice, then were drawn back to their phones. A television above them showed the airport news network, currently a story about Governor Packer.
"They know about me," Faye whispered into Samuel's ear, "that I'm a fugitive. I'm on the run."
"You are neither of those things."
"Of course they know. This is the information age. They all have access to the same data. There's probably a room somewhere covered with TV screens monitoring us right now. It's in Langley or Los Alamos."
"I doubt you'd register as that high a threat." They watched the slow crawl of the line through the security checkpoint, people taking off their shoes and belts and standing in clear plastic tubes and putting their hands over their heads while gray metal arms circled their bodies, probing them.
"This is the post-9/11 world," Faye said, "the post-privacy world. The law knows where I am at all times. Of course they wouldn't let me fly."
"Relax, we don't know what's happening yet."
"And you, they'll arrest you as an accessory."
"Accessory to what? A vacation?"
"They'll never believe we're taking a vacation."
"Aiding and abetting a weekend trip abroad? Hardly criminal."
"We're being watched right now on a bank of televisions and computer screens, probably in the basement of the Pentagon. A feed from every port in the world. Bundles of fiber optic cables. Face recognition software. Technology we don't even know exists. They are probably reading my lips at this exact moment. The FBI and CIA working in conjunction with local law enforcement. That's how they always say it on the news."
"This is not the news.
This is not the news yet.
A man with a clipboard had by now begun talking in low tones with a security agent, glancing at them occasionally. He looked like he'd been pulled from a previous era, his hair cut into a severe and geometric flat top, a white short-sleeved shirt and thin black tie, square jaw, bright blue eyes, like he'd once been an Apollo astronaut but was now doing this. A badge hanging on his shirt pocket turned out to be, upon closer inspection, a laminated card with the image of a badge on it.
"He's talking about us," Faye said. "Something is about to happen."
"Just stay calm.
Do you remember the story I told you about the Nix?"
"Which one was that?"
"The horse."
"Right, yeah. The white horse that picked up children then drowned them?"
"That's the one."
"Excellent story to tell a 9-year-old, by the way."
"Do you remember the moral?"
"That the things you love the most can hurt you the worst?"
"Yes. That people can be a Nix to each other, sometimes without even knowing it."
"What's your point?" The man with the clipboard had begun walking in their direction.
"That's what I was to you," she said. "I was your Nix. You loved me most and I was hurting you. You asked me once why I left you and your father. That's why."
"And you're telling me this now?"
"I wanted to get it in under the wire."
The man with the clipboard crossed the purple tape and cleared his throat. "So it looks like we have sort of a problem here," he said in an unusually upbeat way, like one of those customer service people you sometimes get on the phone who seem really into their jobs. He was not making eye contact with either of them, staring instead at whatever was on his clipboard. "It looks like, it turns out, you're on that no-fly list there." He seemed uncomfortable having to say this, as if it were his fault.
"Yes, I'm sorry," Faye said. "I should have known."
"Oh, no, not you," the man said, looking surprised. "You're not on the list. He is."
"Me?"
"Yes, sir. That's what it says right here," tapping the clipboard. "Samuel Anderson Anderson. Absolutely not allowed on an airplane."
"How am I on the no-fly list?"
"Well," he said, flipping through the pages as if he were reading them for the first time. "Were you recently in Iowa?"
"Yes."
"Did you visit the Chemstar factory while you were there?"
"I stopped by."
"Did you, and here he lowered his voice as if he were saying something obscene.
"Did you take photographs of the factory?"
"A couple, yeah." "Well," he said and shrugged as if the answer should have been obvious, "there you go."
"Why were you taking photographs of Chemstar?" Faye said.
"Yes," the man with the clipboard said. "Why were you?"
"I don't know. It's nostalgic."
"You were taking nostalgic pictures of a factory," the man said. He frowned. He was dubious, not buying it. "Who does that?"
"My grandfather works there. Used to work there." "That part is true," Faye said.
"That part? All of it is true. I was visiting my grandfather and took some pictures of all the old childhood places. The old house, the old park, and yes, the old factory. I think the better question here is why am I on the no-fly list for photographing a corn processing plant?" "Oh, well, those kinds of facilities have some pretty dangerous toxic chemicals, and it's right there on the Mississippi. Let's just say that your presence raised," and here he put up two fingers to indicate air quotes, "homeland security concerns."
"I see."
He flipped to another page on his clipboard. "It says here that they saw you on their closed-circuit cameras and you fled when security approached."
"Fled? I didn't flee. I left. I was done photographing. I never even saw security."
"That's exactly what I would say if I were fleeing," the man said to Faye, who nodded.
"I know," she said. "You're exactly right."
"Would you stop?" Samuel said. "So am I never going to fly again? Is that what this means?"
"It means you're not going to fly today, but you can take steps to remove yourself from the list. There's a website for that."
"A website?"
"Or an 800 number, if you prefer," he said.
"Then an average wait time of 6 to 8 weeks. I'm afraid I'm going to have to escort you out of the airport now."
"And my mother?"
"Oh, she can do whatever she wants. She's not on the list."
"I see. Can you give us a second?"
"Oh, sure," the man said. Then he took one step beyond the purple tape and turned his back 3/4 to them and clasped his hands in front of him and began very slightly tilting back and forth like someone whistling and rocking to his own tune.
"Let's forget about it," they whispered. Let's go home. The judge can do whatever he wants. It's not like I don't deserve it.
And Samuel thought about his mother going to jail, thought about his life returning to normal, losing his job, in debt, alone, passing through his days in a digital fog.
You have to leave, he said. I'll come find you when I can.
Don't be stupid, Faye said. Do you know what the judge will do to you?
A lot less than what he'll do to you. You need to go.
She looked at him a moment, wondering whether to fight him.
Don't argue, he said. Just go.
Fine, she said. But we're not going to have one of those sappy parent-child moments, right? You're not going to cry, right?
I am not going to cry, because I was never very good at dealing with that.
Have a good flight.
Wait, she said.
She grabbed his arm. This has to be a clean break. If we do this, we won't be able to contact each other for a while. Radio silence.
I know.
So I'm asking you, are you prepared to do that? Can you handle that?
You want permission?
Permission to leave you. Again, for the second time. Yes, that's what I want.
Where will you go?
I don't know, Faye said. I'll figure that out in London.
On the television above them, the airport news network came back from commercials and into a segment on the Packer for President campaign. It looked like Governor Packer was out to an early lead in Iowa, they said. Looks like the attack in Chicago really boosted his peripherals.
Faye and Samuel looked at each other.
How did we get into this? He said.
It's my fault, she said. I'm sorry.
Go, he said. You have my permission. Get out of here.
Thank you, she said.
She picked up her bag, looked at him for a moment, then dropped it back on the ground and leaned into Samuel and wrapped her arms around him and buried her face in his chest and squeezed. Samuel didn't know what to do. It was such an out-of-character gesture. She took one long, hard breath like someone about to plunge underwater, then quickly let go.
Be good, she said,
and patted him on the chest. She collected her suitcase and wandered back to the TSA agent, who let her through uneventfully. The man with the clipboard asked Samuel if he was ready to leave, and Samuel watched his mother and felt a little tremble at her sudden embrace. His hand lightly touched the spot she'd pressed her head against.
Sir, said the clipboard man, are you ready?
Samuel was about to say yes when he heard a name he recognized, a name that abruptly popped out of the airport's ubiquitous and usually ignorable noise. It came from the television overhead. Guy Periwinkle. Samuel looked up to see if he'd heard correctly,